I've been covering culture in Kansas City for almost 20 years, and reviews of shows at the Unicorn Theater have fluttered across my desk for just as long. There are certain words that come up again and again, and it does not matter whether the play is about a teenager with Tourette's or a transgender character who uses gender-neutral pronouns, just to give two recent examples. The words people always use when reviewing plays at the Unicorn are bold, courageous, devastating, raw. The plays push boundaries or tackle something taboo. Well, it turns out that for almost 40 years now, there's been an artistic director at the helm guiding that vision. Today, we'll hear how a childhood steeped in activism brought her to the theater and inspired her to challenge audiences in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman and Cynthia Levin. Welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Hi, Gina. It's great to be here.
40 years seems like a pretty long run in a position like yours, and I know I just rounded up, but is that a long time?
Yes, it actually is a long time. You know, most people just don't stay in a job more than 7 or 10 years, and I just have stayed. I didn't even plan to stay 39 years, but here I am. I don't think about it.
I mean, the Unicorn was pretty brand new when you were named Producing Artistic Director. That was in 1981?
Yeah, I came in 79, so just about 4 years or so, a little over 4 years after they started. And a couple of years later, had an opportunity to be the Artistic Director. I did not start as the Artistic Director, but became one.
Tell me about the culture in Kansas City at that moment in time. Like, give me a snapshot of, I don't know, taste, politics. What went over well here? What didn't?
Boy, that was such a different time. I mean, I remember when I came to Kansas City in 1973, from Washington, D.C., you know, and I just drove out here one winter day. And
you just randomly drove here?
I randomly drove here to go to Park College. I had never been west of Philadelphia. So I get to Kansas City and I come over that ASB bridge and I pull over in North Kansas City thinking that was downtown Kansas City. And just pulled over and cried. But it was very different. I remember driving through the Northland, and on one side of the street was, you know, the Black Cemetery, and one was on the other side of the street was the White Cemetery. It was very different. There were no Jews north of the river. There were no synagogues. I mean, it was a very different culture. And when the Unicorn was started, it was because there were really no other theaters. There was the Rep, and there was the Dinner Theater had just started. But it was started because nobody had a place to work. And so three graduate students of UMKC started up this theater so they would have a place to work. And that, you know, it was, there was a couple of course, community theaters, but it was a void. There just wasn't a lot of performing arts going on in the 70s.
Your background, as you have hinted, is not Midwestern, and you're just talking about some initial culture shock. Can you dive into that with some more, I don't know, depth?
Well,
first, maybe starting with that moment where you're pulled over crying.
Right,
what's going through your
right.
head?
It's like, what have I done? I'd lived in this city my whole life and was a little fearful. I mean, I didn't know anything about Kansas City, you know, or much less in Parkville. So it was absolutely a culture shock. And one of the worst things about it was I spent like 5 years looking for a cappuccino and there just wasn't anything. You know, I finally found downtown Kansas City and found the River Quay. And, you know, I did find a good cup of coffee. But that was my quest for, you know, the first couple of years.
So, you know, I understand that activism was part of your life since way before theater. I'd love to hear about your childhood, the people who raised you, like the culture that you were coming from that made the one you found in the 70s in North Kansas City foreign to you.
Growing up in the 60s in Washington, D.C., I mean, wow. What an existence. It just set the tone for everything. I mean, we were in the middle of everything, everything that was happening, which at that time, of course, was the Vietnam War. And it was something that we got involved in, and it was something that we were protesting. And it was, at the time, I wasn't in theater. In my younger life, I was a musician, and I wrote songs, and I played the guitar, and, you know, we played in coffee houses and in rock bands. But every time there was a protest, you know, I was there with my guitar, and we were playing protest songs and Bob Dylan songs, and, you know, that always got the energy going until, you know, you got to where you were going to go. And it was just, you were involved in everything. You couldn't help it because you were living it. You weren't just watching it on TV. So, and my parents were very political. They were always involved, in causes and working on elections. And I mean, I remember my first memory of that was going around with my mother working for John Kennedy, you know, and so
working for John Kennedy, doing what?
Oh, just trying to get out the vote, trying to get people to vote him in. So this was
so
like,
what did you do? Knock on doors?
Yeah. Yeah. We worked. We went to places and, you know, went to rallies and we knocked on doors, you know, and I was a tiny child at that point, you know, so.
But you remember it?
I remember it. I just remember the importance of it. You know, that this was something that needed to happen and we had to work to make it happen. And, you know, that I came out of that time of you can change the world. You know, you can do things and say things and believe in things and it will change what happens in the world. And that sort of was my mindset and that's what I was going to do with my life, which really narrowed sort of my scope of what I could do. It's like, well, can't work in an office. I can't sell insurance. You know, what I never knew what I was going to do, but it had to be something important.
You know, you mentioned when you talked about playing the guitar during protests that it's what got the energy going. Can you talk to me a little bit more about the role of something like music in a political movement and just what you felt sort of viscerally at that young age doing that?
Yeah, I think that I grew up in a very musical household. My brother was a concert violinist. Of course, when I was little, he was not a concert violinist. He was just a violinist. but the music was everything always. You know, we went to concerts and the symphony and everything. So I found that music was just a way to communicate that broke every single boundary there was. It was almost like you could do anything or say anything, and if you did it to music, for some reason, people would listen, which is sort of a lesson today of doing musicals, which I rarely do, but you could almost get away with anything if you have a melody, you know, that and then people go, oh, that's a nice melody. What are you saying? You know, so you can kind of sneak really important things in to a song or even to, to a symphony. I mean, that there's just what it does to one's soul and one's heart, you know, that your heart races and everybody sort of starts visualizing when there's music around. It just, you know, it helps you create. It helps you get energized. I'm not one to meditate in a quiet room.
When you remember these protests that you were a part of, is there one that stands out as being just when you think back to like, oh man, this just captures what that was about for me, for the people I knew? Like, can you take me back to a moment?
Boy, that's interesting to think of one moment because there are so many flashes that I get. Since it was, you know, quite a while ago, I have like now snapshots and, you know, singing by the Liberty Tree or the Freedom Trail or, you know, all of these things that were named at the time. I will remember one of the early July 4ths that was taking place. It must have been probably, you know, 69 or 70. And there was a big, you know, protest that was going on. And July 4th in D.C. down at the mall is like, oh my goodness, you know, it's family oriented. There are, you know, singers singing show tunes and very sweet, you know, American songs are going on. I mean, it's very Americana as you can get. So of course we were down there and there was a protest and there was of course this section where everybody was, you know, smoking different things. I mean, there was just a lot going on to show that there were other people alive in America at that point, you know, besides people that believed in everything that the government was doing, to put it mildly. And all of a sudden, we started to get tear gassed. And I will never forget that image. Gosh, I wish I, you know, had a cell phone at that point and could take in some of those pictures. So we're getting tear gassed in the middle of all of these families sitting with their blanket, you know, on the grass, listening to music and eating fried chicken. And it's like people are just trying to wave it away. I mean, people are trying to absolutely not be aware of what was going on. And all of these other things were going on. And it's like, you know, how can you not be involved with what is going on around you? And
do you think that shapes you as some, like, as far as your idea about theater? I'm wondering, just because the idea of people trying not to pay attention to something and you trying to get their attention?
It must. And I think of, you know, the semantics of words, but I think of the word entertainment because I have to fill out so many forms that say, what do you do? And it's like, well, it's some form of entertainment. But what entertainment means to a lot of people, and I realize to a lot of people, it means I don't want to think. I just want to relax. I want to laugh. I want to just, you know, sit down. And
I want that sometimes.
Yeah, and I can't say that I do. You know, that to me, entertainment is not to not think. I can't imagine what that would be like. You know, it's for me, entertainment is to be involved and to talk about a topic or to be introduced to a subject that I may know nothing about. And then isn't this great? We can all sit down and talk about this and think about what it might be like to be that other person and to learn about empathy, which I think I just was introduced at such a young age. And somehow the importance of it meant that, you know, how can I be involved in something that could be a learning experience for my entire life? And to also involve others, because theater, unlike possibly art or music, which is could be a little bit more solitary, theater is not solitary. If you do not have other people around you or an audience,
it's just talking to yourself in that case.
It's just reading a book. Yeah. So it's that was a really great segue for me to make that jump into, oh my goodness, I can do something here.
But can I get back into, you know, we've heard about the passion that you felt at protests and what these scenes were like. What motivated you to be there in the first place? Like, do you remember what sort of activated, I know that it's the act of being present is something that it sounds like your family introduced you to, but as far as your own passions about justice, what justice means when it's not evident, where does that come from?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You know, I can't say that I was born with that because I don't really know what we're born with. My grandmother was an activist. My grandmother was a socialist that, of course, immigrated to the United States.
From where?
From Russia. And she was like the most important person in my life. She was, you know, my idol. And she was always involved in a cause, always raising money for something.
Was she outspokenly socialist? Because I'm thinking outspoken socialist and also Jewish, right?
Yep.
That
outspoken.
Challenging.
Absolutely challenging, to the point where you loved her and would do anything for her and follow her through fire, or you didn't like her very much because she was outspoken about everything. And she was also, she lost her husband very early, I think when my mom was like 20. So, you know, here was this woman who, you know, came from Russia and was living a fairly traditional life in the way of, you know, being married and raising children, and then was plunged into single motherhood and adulthood. And she made her way, and it never mattered to her really what she was doing to make money. She would work in a dress shop. She would work, you know, for somebody else just to make enough money to live. That wasn't important. What was important was what you did with your life and all the other time and doing something. And so hence she never made any money, really. You know, I mean, she was able to live, but that was not what I saw was, oh, you have to get a job and make a lot of money and have a nice car and buy a house. Never was that sort of my goal.
When you say that she was plunged into single motherhood, what do you mean?
Oh, well, her husband died. And, you know, and at that time, what her skills were, similar to what my grandfather's skills were coming from Russia. I mean, I always ask, what was my grandfather? What did he do? And he was a scholar. And it's like, a scholar? Well, how did he make any money in America? What is a scholar? You know, it's like, oh, he worked in a liquor store, you know? And it was like, oh, right. You know, and so my grandmother was out. She started the first Yiddish-speaking school in Washington, D.C., the Chaim Weizmann School. You know, she was going to all of these places to, you know, to do things and, you know, change the culture or try to, you know, put her imprint on the culture and make it better for people, raise money for people who didn't have any money, but she didn't have any money either. So just the balance, I think, of what I saw of social activism didn't really tie into necessarily what your career would be. I watched my father. My father was an artist. He was a jazz musician. He was a painter, but he grew up, you know, in a culture in the 40s, you know, after World War II, that, and his parents, he was not even born in this country, but, you know, the immigrant sort of mind of, you got to get a good job and you got to do better than us and you got to be a professional. So he became a lawyer, you know, and it's like, yeah, but that's not what you want to do at all. That's not what's in your heart. So I watched that struggle in him his whole life of, but I have to, you know, make this pretty good living, and I want a family, and I want my kids to have everything I didn't have, and, you know, grow up in a nice house. And that's what his job was supposed to be, even though, you know, the minute he wasn't working, he was painting or he was playing his trumpet. You know, it was like, I couldn't do that. I knew I wanted to follow my heart.
It sounds like you had a lot of training in being sort of out in public at the center of a spectacle, and not just any spectacle, but one that might put you at odds with strangers.
You know, that's true, which really just was great training for what I do now, because I'm constantly sort of just out in public with strangers, who, many of who I've gotten to know. But that's true. I mean, I didn't stay in my room. You're thrown in with a group. I remember being in New Hampshire for the primary, working for McGovern. I mean, in 72, I mean, I was a teenager. So that never frightened me to the point of, oh, I can't do that. I can't do that. There's people watching. Oh, I can't play and sing in front of people. There's people watching. That never was any sort of deciding factor of what I would do or not.
I've heard that you grew up singing Bob Dylan in Hebrew school.
Yeah, I sang Bob Dylan everywhere. But that's true, because I think for my, I don't think I played for my bat mitzvah, but for my confirmation, I wrote the service, and I remember playing my 12-string guitar, The Times They Are Changin'. You know, this was like in, I don't know, probably, well, mid-60s, and I can't believe the rabbi let me do that. You know, you think of something that's pretty traditional, conservative, but, you know, and I got everybody to sort of come along with me and do this story and do this with me, because it felt important. It just didn't feel like a time to be complacent.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to Cynthia Levin this morning. It's a portrait session, which means we have deemed Cynthia someone who makes Kansas City an interesting place to live. It also means this conversation will go up online over the weekend with photos of Cynthia by Paul Andrews. Cynthia Levin, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
So I understand that theater came as kind of an epiphany to you. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I wasn't, my plan, if I had a plan, it was a very obtuse plan, but my plan was to be a musician, and everybody, hey, what are you going to do with that? And I went, I don't know, it doesn't matter, I'm just going to play and sing and live my life. And a lot, my brother was a musician, and he was also in theater, so that combination, so of course he was my older brother, and, you know, I followed him around a lot and did a lot of what he was doing. And he would conduct the orchestra for the summer theater. And so every summer, I would be involved in the theater. And I, you know, started painting backstage, and I would usher the shows, and I would sort of learn how that was going on. And then I would audition when I got to high school for some of the plays. And it wasn't until really college. I came to Park College as a music and art major.
And that decision still intrigues me, but we'll get back to that.
Yeah, that is intriguing. but so that's it. When I got into theater, I found a community. I mean, my music was mine, you know, and that was, I would create it on my own and then share it. With theater, it was a community. You created it with other people. And it, I found this one thing that I could give 100% of my energy to, and it was okay. It wasn't like, hey, that's too much. Oh, you're, you know, calm down. Hey, take, you know.
Wait, was that something that had been kind of like a refrain?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it was just like the energy. I had difficulty, we shall say, in public school, and I never was good at sitting at a desk, listening to teachers, and then you would go to another room and sit and listen, and that I was not good at that. So I got into trouble a lot, just, you know, and it wasn't for like big, bad things, but for
just
speaking
disruptive.
Out, for being disruptive, for, you know, saying things I shouldn't. I mean, I remember very early on, I want to say I was maybe in, I don't know, eighth grade or something, that I wrote a paper for my English class on capital punishment, and it was like, whoa, hey, you know, what are we talking about here? You know, and it's like that, well, this is important, and this is, you know, and I
was it like, how about ant farms?
I know, right. And everything was just seemed like there wasn't anything that I could do that all of my energy was okay and accepted. And in theater, it was demanded. You know, if you didn't have enough energy to work on the show and stay up all night and learning your lines or working on a crew, or, you know, then you did not excel. So this was something I felt was perfectly, this was a perfect framework for me, that I could work as much as I wanted, and nobody thought that was odd, or that, hey, you know, are you hyperactive? Are you? I mean, they would say, you know, ADD, except for that we didn't have that then. But you know, just that I always wanted to be doing something. I was not, you know, a solitary, quiet child. So this helped me once, you know, I found creativity and like was writing music and doing all of these other things. It helped me deal with the world. It just didn't help me in public school.
You know, we've mentioned that you started out with a role at the Unicorn that was not artistic director. The role that you have is one, though, that you took on pretty young. Can you tell me the story of how that happened?
Yeah, it was you know, being at the right place at the right time. I mean, I don't know what we call that, fate or karma or whatever. I was hired to do a multiple number of jobs, as most of us were doing at that time.
Jobs such as,
for every single show, I would either be acting in it, I would be directing it, or I would be stage managing it. And I still, for many years at this point, tackled the music and the sound design. I wrote a lot of music for shows. I did all of the sound effects for about 15 or 20 years for the Unicorn and the Coterie. So it was sort of keeping that one hand and one foot in the music scene and bringing that into the theater. So I was doing all of that pretty much all the time, and from show to show to show, helping build the sets. I mean, we learned to do all of it, which I just think was a pretty great way to get into the theater, to learn a little bit about everything.
Is that still how people do it?
No, not particularly. And it's what, if I get any say to tell people what maybe they should learn to do, because it ensures you don't have to have a job doing all of those many things, but it allows you to have vocabulary. like if you're an actor, especially as a director now, of being able to talk to the sound designer, lighting designer, the builders, or the, you know, read a ground plan that the set designer gives you, that you understand what everybody else does in their job and you're able to have a conversation about it. I find that if people are very, you know, insular and they're, you know, the solitary, well, I understand this part of it, but I don't really get, so go write your light cues. And that doesn't work because then it's not conceptual. You must be able to understand how every piece of theater adds to the other piece of theater. So I thought it was great learning all of that. And so I did all of it as much as I could. But a couple years later, it was a very dramatic scene. And the artistic director at the time walked into our end of the year board meeting when the next season was going to be announced. And she walked in and said, "I quit," and walked out. And it was like, you know, everybody's just looking at each other going, "What was that? What do we do? What's going on?" And nobody had any idea. So I was at the table. And
it is fittingly theatrical.
It was so theatrical. It was, yeah, it was almost like, oh my gosh, you know, couldn't you have done it some other way? But I raised my hand. I said, you know what? I'll do it. I'd love to do it. And so for a year, I was given the interim job of artistic director. And I have to say that I never thought ever before really this time of being a leader, being an artistic director of a theater. I was just an artist. I was an artist, you know?
Yeah.
But what I came to learn about being a freelance artist or being an artist without an artistic home is you have to work on whatever is out there to work on. So, you know, you would audition, or I would get in a play, and I didn't like what the play was saying. I didn't want to do what the play was doing. I didn't believe in it. And I realized, oh, no, I can't be a freelance artist because I only want to do theater that means something to me, that is saying something to someone else.
So you can't just do the hustle of taking the jobs that are there. You have to make the jobs.
Right. I couldn't do it. So I needed an artistic home. I needed a place where I could be involved in the creation of something that was bigger than just, oh, sure, I'll learn the lines and do whatever and, you know, play somebody's nutty mother or whatever it is that you have to do.
So I am curious, what kinds of roles made you feel really uneasy just about the messages you were possibly sending?
I think most of it was about being young women and what that meant at the time, and being overtly sexual and getting your way through, like, flirtation or different way. I mean, the theater even now today is, of course, somewhat about that too. I mean, sex farces and comedies, which I have to say, I don't do a lot of comedies because I find in comedies you use a base of humor very often that I don't find particularly funny. It's at someone else's expense. I grew up in a very integrated world, and I thought that was important to keep the theater integrated, whether it was on stage or backstage or the playwrights or the writers that were working. And I didn't see a lot of that, and I wanted to make that happen. I wanted to be a place where that could happen.
What does an artistic director do exactly?
I don't know. It's everything. You're involved in every production, and you're either directing or, you know, it's still.
If you had to write a short job description of artistic director, what does it say?
The producing artistic director at the Unicorn, which, you know, it's all different, and it depends on the size of your theater. And we're a fairly small organization. We have 8. You know, full-time staff people. It's not huge. So we all do, you know, a little bit of everything. But primarily, my primary job and what I take greatest responsibility, of course, is choosing a season, choosing all of the plays and why and the importance of that. And then from there, it's choosing the directors if I'm not directing, helping cast every single show and find designers for every single show, working with my staff and, you know, trying to work collaboratively and make sure that everyone, you know, in the building can work collaboratively. And that's kind of hard because it's not something we necessarily come to a job knowing how to do. You come with a certain skill, but do you know how to sit at a table and talk about it and, you know, and not even compromise, but make the thing better by talking about it and getting input? And I always really believe is you're as good as the people around you. So I make sure that the people around me are really good because they make me look better. You know, it's just if everybody's doing their job well, then we are an incredible force. So, you know, trying to create that environment, which is, you know, sometimes easier than others. I mean, what happens when we're not doing well? You know, what happens when the economy dips? And I just think of the decades I've gone through. What happens when the NEA, you know, is asking you to censor your shows? I mean, all of the things.
Can you back up and talk about that?
Yeah, that was a tough one. Going through the NEA business, you know, the Mapplethorpe, and so they wanted to get every theater to sign a waiver that you would not do anything that, you know, was I don't, you know, this is a hard one to qualify. But
remind us of the Mapplethorpe incident.
Oh, the Mapplethorpe was funded, he was an artist, funded by the NEA, and when, of course, he did his gallery, there were paintings that depicted what some people thought were anti-Christian, anti-religious, anti-God. And he was making very, very strong, important statements. So the NEA came under such fire that they decided that they needed a censorship clause, of which I would never sign. And I still wrote the grants, but I would never sign that clause because the one thing at the Unicorn is that there is no censorship. If it is important, if it needs to be in the play and it needs to be on the stage, whether it's content or whatever. I mean, there has been nudity. There has been difficult language.
There have been puppets doing all sorts of untoward things.
There have been nude puppets doing sex. I mean, oh my God. So, right. But what if I think it's important, if it is an important story to tell, we will tell it. I do not choose things gratuitously. If it's not important to the story or to the way that we have to present it, then it won't happen. But we, you know, got this sort of reputation of, oh, yeah, that's the theater that does all the plays about women. That's the place that does all the plays about African-Americans and the naked ones and the gay, that, you know, it's like, and that's because nobody else was doing any of it. So if we would do, you know, one play about an African-American gay man, that's who we were because it stood out. Now I think there's a little bit more of spreading that around, but there sure wasn't in the 80s and 90s. And so we got this sort of reputation of doing that. And that, okay, that's fine.
I understand that there's also a rule for you to only stage plays that have not been seen before in Kansas City.
Yes. And that's like, I love that rule, that my self-imposed rule. It's just that we sort of paint ourselves in a corner because that means I can only find plays that have never played in Kansas City or usually even in the Midwest region and very often.
Why do you have that rule?
Because I want to show people in Kansas City something they have never seen. If people can see it, then that's great. But I want to bring things that people would not get a chance to see unless they leave Kansas City. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's really not an option. I mean, not everybody goes to New York 4 or 5 times a year and can see all of the new things, or possibly Chicago. And so I want those shows. I want to bring them to my home and my community, you know, sometimes before they even get to New York, or possibly right after they've played in New York. And so some people have seen it, if they are travelers. But that's really important to me. If I've done something before, if I've done a show before, if I've seen a show before, I want to move on. it's time to do something else. And in contemporary theater, the new thing is being written today or tomorrow. So I get to find what's absolutely about our life today and put it on the stage.
You know, this is interesting because it seems like as the bigger cultural conversation changes, part of what someone has to do to continue to be seen as edgy or radical, it means not just staying current, but staying, in fact, one step ahead. And for to do that for multiple decades seems hard. And right now, you know, what subject matter a theater deals with kind of pales in comparison to who is being given a voice.
Right.
That's where the cultural conversation really is right now.
Right. It, I think it's right now not as difficult because people, whether people are more sophisticated now or they are forced into hearing and seeing things that they have not before. But I can tell you before, doing something that was new in a different way, showing people on stage that people weren't used to seeing on stage or presenting a certain story, it was not nearly as accepted. It was very interesting, but it's how we got our success, but it's also, you know, what people were...
Can you give an example of something that, you know, maybe where you brought a conversation to the stage that people weren't 100% ready to have?
Yeah, I mean, I think primarily in a more general way, we've always done original works. You know, 20% of what we do are world premieres. So I would bring a world premiere to the theater, and because no one had ever heard of it, they didn't want to come. You know, that people were so used to just sort of seeing things or spending money to see things.
Cats. I love Cats.
Absolutely. Singers that they knew. You're not going to go to a concert and pay, you know, at the time, maybe $25-$30 to see a new artist. You would go to see the artist you know and be able to sing along on the songs. So to present shows that people had never heard of was deadly. It was very difficult to get an audience for shows, and that's whether they were world premiere or just a new show.
But you clearly developed some trick.
Yes, yes, we did. And I think...
What is it?
I think presenting interesting shows well. And so people thought, oh, this isn't so bad. Oh, this is kind of fun.
But how did you get them there in the first place?
I don't know. Just sheer will and endurance.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a portrait session with the Unicorn Theater's Cynthia Levin on KCUR's Central Standard. Cynthia grew up in Maryland and came to Kansas City having never been west of Philadelphia. She experienced a little culture shock right at first, but then she came around, and now she gives Kansas City culture shock on a regular basis. At least, that's her reputation. With boundary-pushing plays at the Unicorn. Hi again, Cynthia.
Hi, Gina.
Okay, so you've talked about this experience you had coming to Kansas City, having grown up in Washington, D.C. in the 60s, then arriving in Kansas City in the 70s, North Kansas City to be specific, to attend Park University, and that you pulled over and cried when you arrived. What brought you here? What, I mean, if for a person who's never been west of Philadelphia, how do you think to yourself, I think I'll go to Kansas City?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. When I was in high school in the early 70s, there were a lot of educational projects going on. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Summerhill. They came out of England, but there were alternative schools were starting for people who were not good in a classroom, who needed to learn in other ways by doing or being, you know, somewhere else. That so I got in one of these projects. It was called Project in Education in the school system, and it was fantastic. I mean, there were a couple of subjects you sort of had to go and write papers and be in a classroom, but it was a pass-fail. So at the end of high school, I didn't really have a grade point average. I passed, you know, and it's like, oh, that's great, said the colleges. I'm so glad. And And I was thinking of going to a couple places, you know, in New England. I got out of high school early from this project I was in and moved up to Boston because my brother lived there. He was had been going to school in Boston and went up there. And I didn't really have plans to go to college. I was going to live my life, right? But every single friend I made and every single person I met in Boston was going to college. And they went, what are you talking about? Why aren't you going to college? So I thought, oh my God, I have to go to college. And everything was so incredibly expensive on the East Coast. And so I thought, I don't know what to do. My parents had a friend whose kid was an artist and he wasn't great, you know, in classroom, traditional classroom situations. And he went to Park College in Parkville, Missouri. And I talked to him, and he said, oh, that's great, man. It's really liberal. It's, you know, there's only, you know, 10 people in a class, and, you know, everything's about hands-on experience. And so I thought, well, guess I'll try it. And I also didn't know anyone within 1,000 miles in any direction. And I thought, well, maybe that'll mean I can concentrate on going to school. Because I don't have, I mean, in Boston.
Because that didn't come naturally to you.
No, and in Boston, I was involved in everything. And the feminist movement was new, and I was involved in, you know, getting into that. And it was just so much going on that I was doing a lot of things. And so I thought, I'm going to go to this little town in Missouri where I don't know anyone, and I'm going to do something else. So I followed, and there was quite a few Washingtonians who were going to Park College. So I followed them. We did a little car caravan beginning of February in 1973. And we drove out here through one snowstorm after the other. And I landed. And I did not ever think I would stay. In fact, I think the faculty were taking bets. Nah, she's not going to stay. Oh, yeah, I think she's going. No, she's not going to stay. But it was interesting because I found it very segregated. I, of course, knew the people I came with from Washington, all African Americans, found a house. We all, you know, lived together in the house, and it was frowned upon in the neighborhood.
How did you know that?
There were things that would happen and things that were said, and I was sort of told by several of the students of what we could and couldn't do on our way to campus or when we got to campus. It was like, oh, screw that. I'm not doing that. You know, it's like, let it come, you know, and it was just, there were just some things at that time that were a little new, but it was so cool because there were so many East Coast people here. So we could really share a little bit of that, you know, that adaptation we had to make to the rural, at the time, rural Midwest. But yeah, it was, I actually did leave for a while, for a year, and moved back to D.C. because it was just hard. It was a hard transition. But I went back and interned at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. And then Park lured me back to graduate. They go, you want to graduate? This is your chance. This may be your only chance to graduate.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they wanted you back?
I think they hopefully, maybe, possibly saw something in me that was helpful to their program, to the theater. They, you know, I mean, I think they were heavy into recruitment, and it was quite a strong theater program. But they offered me a full scholarship if I would come back for my last year and graduate. And, I mean, I think when I was there, that's all I did. You know, that's what I did. I worked as hard as anyone could work to, you know, in that program. So I think that that's the people they were looking for. I mean, I think always it's like, who could maybe succeed? Who could maybe go on and do something in the theater, in their life? And maybe somebody there hopefully saw that in me. I don't know.
I mean, I've mentioned this a few times, but you are known for boldness and, you know, everyone has doubts. Everyone has insecurities. And I'm curious about when yours have really been stirred up, either personally or professionally, and then how you, in some way, got past that.
It's interesting because I don't really live out of a place of fear. That is not a place that I go to. And I have to look at that intellectually sometimes of what kinds of shows absolutely nobody wants to see or nobody will come to, because after all, I mean, you do need even a small audience, you know, to do theater, or to do theater for the long haul. This isn't like, well, we're going to do one show. I'm going to do 7 or 8 shows a year forever.
And the audience has to have some level of buy-in. But
right.
I don't totally buy that there's a human being who doesn't get fear.
Well, of course I get it. Of course I get it. And there are moments, of course, and instances that it's like, oh, no. But that's not how I make choices.
Gotcha.
Right. And so the...
So how do you not make a choice that way?
I choose things that I believe in. I mean, that may be simplification, but that if I think it's good, if I think it's important, then other people will too. And I can look back and think of a couple of shows maybe that people did not relate to or people did not see the merit, you know? And so I catalog those and know that, okay, this, my audience is not going to be interested in, and it's not worth the fight. Sometimes you pick your battles and it's like, this show is totally worth the fight. People are going to love it and I'm going to do it no matter what. And I think of one example, back in the early 90s, it was financially a very turbulent time for the theaters. There wasn't a lot of funding. People were, you know, going under all the time. And we were having a hard, hard year. And we looked sort of at what we could do to try to cut expenses. And at the end of the season was a musical. And my board said, you know, we think maybe we should cancel the musical and do a little tiny show that's not going to cost much money. Well, that musical was Falsettoland. And this was a show that was important for my soul to do. Everything about it, it was brand new. It was just starting to play in New York, just had moved to Broadway, and I had the rights to do it, which was odd because I got the rights before it moved to Broadway.
But why was it important to your soul?
It was important because of the story, because it was about a family, and it was like a Jewish family, and they had a kid, but then the father realized he was gay and left his family and found a partner. And then that partner turned out to be HIV positive. And then it was the kid's bar mitzvah. And how are we going to, you know? And so it was about all of these elements of story that came together in such a supportive, loving way that you're not sure how it's going to end up. And it was a musical. It was all sung. And I knew that whether some of these issues were going to be hard for people to accept, you know, in many different ways.
I mean, now we have musicals like Hamilton.
Oh, my gosh, that's like, I know.
But that trend, that didn't quite exist then.
Not at all. This was in 93. And, you know, it didn't. But I thought this was so important for me to do. And we talked about it. I just remember. And this is how I remember it. I think this is how it happened. But we were in the board meeting and they said, we think you should, you know, give up the musical and pick another show. And I think I said something like, over my dead body. So we did the show and it was the most successful show we had ever done.
Well, were you scared that it was going to be a flop and that you were going to sort of be on the line for that? That you were going to have done this to the unicorn? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I guess I could think about that every show we do, you know, that I think is going to be amazing and sell out. And oftentimes, you know, what you don't expect will happen. But that's not how I can choose. I do not want to get to a place that I choose it for commercial reasons. I mean, there are other ways that we can make money. We raise a lot of money. But I have to do what's right.
You know, we're, as you can hear, on our way out. But I just, before we go, is there ever a piece of advice you've gotten that served you well and stuck with you that you think might do the same for the listeners?
To be courageous and do what you think is right. Stay with what you love.
Well, Cynthia Levin, congratulations on heading into the Unicorn's 45th season.
45th season at the Unicorn.
And your 40th.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Gina.
Cynthia Levin is Artistic Director of Kansas City's Unicorn Theater, and this has been a portrait session. We'll have it online with photos by Paul Andrews in the next day or so. Head to kcur.org/centralstandard. to check it out. kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where you'll find all the conversations we've had this week. Yesterday's show about the tensions between feeding the homeless and following food safety regulations is worth a listen while you're there. We also talked with a rapper who goes by Sauce. He has a new album dedicated to black men, and it includes an apology to black women. That's a wrap for the week. Talk to us on Twitter if you want. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.